accession number 17117, reel 7.
Mr. Coker, reel 7.
I suppose the curacao, or rather the survivors from the curacao, were the dirtiest group of survivors that we had come across. Dirtiest in so much that poor devils had oil fuel, but most of them covered very, very much with oil fuel. And I presume that the Queen Mary, when she cut the ship into two, must have gone through one or more oil tanks. And this meant that the survivors presented quite a problem on coming aboard the ship with great bales of cotton wool used to get the fuel from them. And indeed, there was one particular instance where, and I don't know if oil fuel played a part in this, but we had down in our mess a number of survivors. And indeed, this is where I can say that the curacao were among the dirtiest survivors we came across, because Urania was, being a junior captain, that's only a lieutenant as a captain, was detailed off as being a survivor ship. In other words, we were always detailed off in any operation to pick up survivors. So we had quite a wide experience of having a number of ship's companies or survivors of ship's companies aboard us. And in this particular one, this particular instance, and relating to the oil fuel and the part it may have played, we had, in fact, a chappie down in our mess. I feel that he might have been a signalman, a yeoman of signals. He was a chief petty officer. And he was quite a bright cockney type. And he was chatting away down in the mess, and saying how lucky he felt that he'd survived, and we'd picked him out of the drink, etc., and we'd given him some rum, and he was bright as ninepence, and he was saying that his wife would be quite surprised to see him home, because the curacao's ship's company had only just come back from leave, and she will probably say to him, "What are you doing home now, you know, you've just gone back, etc." Well, he was talking in this vein, and he seemed to be, you know, what one might say, I suppose, as well as possibly could be. And then, of course, as time went on and we're coming to return to Londonderry, which would take a few hours to get back to Derry, and he said, "Oh, I think I'll get my head down." And he just then lay down on the lockers to go to sleep, which was quite a natural thing for any survivors, get head down. And when we got into Londonderry, I'm afraid when he was given a shake, he was dead. And we had no idea how this could have been, and whether it was shock or whether it was oil got in his lungs, what it was. But he gave no sign whatever whilst he was asleep of, from the people in the mess, said he didn't shout or, you know, cry out in any way. He was just dead. And that was, you know, quite a surprise to us. There was another survivor, in fact, several survivors would not go down below decks. This chap, he did. He came down into our mess, and I said, "What's happened to him?" But other survivors would not go down below decks. They remained on the upper deck, and as chill as it was there. And one of them I was speaking to, an ERA, that's an engine room artificer, he said to me that, "No fear, I'm not going down below now." He said, "I was in the ship," because I asked him why, and he said, "Well, I, in the ship in the curacao, we'd just finished lunchtime, and we turned to, that is, going back to work in the afternoon, and he went down into the workshop, and he put his overalls on and just started up the lathe on which he was working. And just as he started the lathe, he thought there was something wrong with the motor at first, because there's a jolt and just a rush. And all he can recollect that he looked up And he said, quite honestly, it was just the side of the Queen Mary I saw going through the end of the compartment in which he was. And he said, that's all it could have been. There was just this jolt and a tearing sound and this great scraping noise going on. And the scraping noise then finished, and there's this great wall of water, and he found himself out in the water. And there he was, swimming for his life. And he said, there's no way that I'm going to go down below at this moment of time. And I suppose with an experience like that, one could understand his sentiments on that. And we picked up, I'm pleased to say that we, and as I said earlier, in our role as a survival ship, or a survivorship, we used to go out with the ropes around us and grab hold of men in the water, and our colleagues aboard the ship would pull on the rope and drag us and the survivor back to the ship's side so that we could put them onto a scrambling net and bring them inboard. And we did this as a matter of, well, it was almost a sort of thing, an unwritten thing that we did, and it worked very, very well. And of the six destroyers that went out to meet the Curacao and the Queen Mary, three were detailed to stay behind, and we were one of them. The very old destroyer, the Skate, was another, and I can't recollect whether it was the Ledbury or the Bicester, was another Hunt class, but we picked up something, I think, about, if my memory serves me, about 97 of the survivors. The Skate, I think, picked up about 5, so a very old ship, and the Ledbury about 20. So out of the whole ship's company of 450 in the Curacao, I'm afraid, well, the most that we could possibly have picked up would not have been, I don't suppose, much more than 125, 130. So the loss of life was, I suppose, really not only serious, but of course, I suppose it fell within, well, the normality, I suppose, of naval sinkings in the war. I mean, not comparable with the Hood, which only had 3 survivors out of about 1,600, whatever. Anyway, with our 97, we were quite a dirty ship in that we had quite a lot of oil around the place in our mess sticks and that sort of thing. And we made our way back to Londonderry. And when we got back into Derry, of course, it was late at night, and we then discharged all our human cargo, as it were, and the clean-up operation started. But as my memory serves me, I feel that the cleaning, we felt a little happier about this, because I think the very next day we were granted boiler clean leave from Londonderry. And though, I mean, we had 7 days boiler clean leave, it meant that I was going to Plymouth, and where my wife and my family, my parents were. And I can remember it took us 36 hours to get from Londonderry to Plymouth and 36 hours back again, so that, I mean, there were 3 days of the leave gone in travelling and on all the usual stations, blacked out in wartime, that sort of thing. But anyway, it was quite welcome. We, after that, as my memory serves me, I think we did a convoy after that in the Atlantic. And the convoys were quite, really, very boring, as one might imagine. They were absolutely boring, interspersed with periods of great activity, in that there'd be a sudden jolt and alarm, and then quite panic stations, and all hell seemed to pop. But on this particular convoy, one incident which stood out in my mind was the loss of a Sunderland aircraft. And this, I thought, again, was quite tragic. It's one of the things that stick out in my mind. These aircraft used to appear now and again, as one is nearing Britain. And we were down off the southwest approaches, and this Sunderland appeared and circled the convoy. And I can remember going up on deck, and I suppose it must have been quite about 7:30. This is just after we'd fallen out from dawn action stations, and then we'd had breakfast, and I went up on deck, and I'd seen the Sunderland, and then I went down below again, and I didn't see this happen. But apparently the Sunderland, because one thing that crossed my mind when I saw the Sunderland, I thought, you know, that comes out from Plymouth, that comes from Mountbatten. After his patrol, he will go back to Mountbatten, and he will be in the pub at night in Plymouth, and I'll still be ploughing along at sea. Oh, what it must be to be an airman, and etc. And of course, this is the envy of looking up at that Sunderland and thinking, oh well, they'll get over their patrol and it's quite well done, and they'll go back home. But what I didn't know what was to come, because I didn't see this. But apparently what had happened was that the Sunderland went turn in a kind of I don't know quite what he had in mind, but he did a run down between the rows of the convoy. And he was, of course, one must bear in mind, a way out on the horizon, then came in. And one of the merchant ships, I regret to say, the Dems gunners, shot this Sunderland down. And when I got up on deck, later, they told me the Sunderland had been shot down, and it had come down in the water, and the crew had got out and were on the wing and waving, and I don't know whether it be their fist or whatever, but they were looking to be picked up, and then suddenly the aircraft blew up, which we thought was particularly tragic, and the whole thing, and they obviously were killed. And that is that kind of thing which sticks in your mind. We did, I feel, one then convoy towards Russia. We were not part of that because we carried no torpedo tubes, and quite frankly, as a Hunt class destroyer, we were quite useless to any fleet operation. So we were detailed off as a task of here just looking after and nursing a tanker or two, and we ended up in Iceland. But life then became a little bit of a drudgery, just ploughing around in these always rough northern waters, until we suddenly were detached off down into the Mediterranean. And we arrived down in Gibraltar, and this would now be the end of October, of early November, and of 42, if my memory serves me on this. And we thought we were going to be then off on another convoy to Malta. And after our experience with Pedestal, I must say we weren't particularly looking forward to this. But when we put to sea, and of course we always seem to go out on these operations with nights of no moon and this sort of thing to clear Gibraltar, because of course the Germans were well installed over in La Linea on the other side of Gibraltar, and they always seemed to have their binoculars on us, and they always knew that the harbour was cleared next morning, when in fact it had been full the day before. But when we had cleared Gibraltar, we were told that we were in fact off on the invasion of North Africa, and we were then told that our objective was going to be Algiers, and our function was going to be the bombarding of a particular shore battery at one end of the Algiers harbour. And bearing in mind the experience that we'd had and problems with our twin 4-inch during Pedestal, I being responsible for the maintenance of the 4-inch mountings. In fact, all gunnery material and fire control material in the Brabham was not particularly looking forward to this. Anyway, as the event happened, we were not called upon to do any bombarding at all, and the two ships which were to ram the boom and got in, they were the ones which bore the brunt of the operation, and the French surrendered, and Algiers was taken, and of course we landed, and we were very relieved to find that that was of course obviously the case. But what we didn't realise was that soon we were detailed off in Brabham. There were 7 of us. We started off in what was later known as the Inshore Squadron. But one of our first tasks I can remember was going along the coast from Algiers, and we went along to a place called Bouilly, just along to the east of Algiers. And of course now it will have very different, all these places will be named differently now, but we went into Bouilly, and we were going to do the same sort of operation there, in so much that hopefully there would be a peaceful surrender, but if there wasn't, we had to be prepared to shoot it out with whatever artillery they had mounted there. And I can remember coming into this little bay in Bouilly, and at first sight it seems that they were going to resist, and I can remember then there was a great deal of shall we say what now, etc., is likely to happen on the bridge. And I can remember even talking, going down to get the wardroom tablecloth to take up to the mast to show that we were in fact friendly and there's no need to open fire. But I can remember the mayor coming out, and with a few dignitaries, and of course that was it. Bouilly turned out to accept us. But
these are the Vichy French.
Yes, these are the Vichy French. I'm sorry about that. I ought to have said that. They were not particularly well disposed towards us, but they did, I suppose, recognise that, well, the odds were very much against them. From Bouilly, we then went along the coast to Philippeville and then to Beaune. A similar sort of operation each time, and we were in fact probing our way along that North African coast. And of course the army for their part and the RAF were doing their stuff on land, whereby they were looking to advance as far as they could through Algeria into Tunisia as a kind of pincer movement, where the 8th Army was coming the other way from Alamein through that way. And of course that hadn't quite started at that time, but that of course is what happened. But one of the things which did happen was that of course the operation, it seemed, had overreached itself, in so much that the advance units of army and indeed RAF some aircraft had got to Beaune, which is right on the borders of Tunisia, and they were out of fuel and out of ammunition and that sort of thing. And it worked out then that here it transpired that we were to be the carriers, because one of the group had tried to take a tanker up to Beaune, but the thing had been hit and blown up. And of course the Germans, of course, by this time were mounting all resistance they could possibly do against us. But we then, what developed into a kind of mini Tobruk run, in so much that we used to load up with ammunition of mortars, that is, mortar shells and of all kinds of required by the army. And we would then dash from Algiers at night and go at full speed up to Beaune and furiously unload this lot for the army and then dash back again. And it became quite hairy, this, because on the trips up from Algiers to Beaune, you'd have the German aircraft over you dropping flares on the way, and of course the routing was there to, if you saw a flare, to steam underneath it to get the flare between you and the aircraft. Anyway, this tended to be quite one of the hottest, if I may put it that way, experiences, indeed even worse, if I may, or hotter, if you like, than the pedestal operation, because we found that in Bugi became quite a hot spot. They brought a monitor up there, and I can't understand for the life of me, even now when I look back on it, a great big monitor, a 15-inch, and I'm trying to think of its name. Oh dear, it's gone. Wasn't Erebus. But anyway, this monitor was hit several times by Junkers 88s, and we ourselves used to be bombed. Well, quite frankly, I mean, it almost seemed to be about an hourly occurrence that they would come out from Sicily or Sardinia, and you'd have a few or quite a number of attacks, and there was always one major one. Our major attacks always occurred at dawn and at dusk, and indeed another sad occasion on this happened on one particular night in Bugi, or off Bugi that is. We had a particularly heavy attack, and we were with the Bister, our chummy ship as it were, and we both survived the attack. But when we got back into Algiers, the motorboat from the Bister came alongside, and our messman shouted to me and said, "Oh, Reggie," he said, "the motorboat tells me." And I went over to the port and looked out, because in harbour you open up port, and the coxswain of the motorboat told me that my opposite number, the OA on the Bister, had been killed in that attack the night before. And though the Bister had not been hit, he had been killed by a piece of shrapnel from their own shells. It seems that because we had been firing, we used to fire something like 400 rounds of 4-inch before breakfast, as it were, as a kind of warm-up, and barrels, the gun barrels, I presume, must have been wearing, with the result that the muzzle velocity was slowing. But anyway, it seems that in this attack in Bugi, this particularly heavy attack, which involved, as two, if I remember, torpedo bombers as well, that the after gun, one of the after guns of the Bister in firing forward, and this laddie, his name Taylor was on the pom-pom, was just above the bridge. This shell exploded, and that's the Bister's own shells exploded. And at first the crew of the pom-pom thought that he had ducked because of the bomb coming down around and the spray. And when the bombers, this particular bomber dropped its bomb, they looked down and said, "Come on, Buck," you see, and all Taylor's and his Buck, and because he was lying on the deck beside the gun, and it seemed that a piece of shrapnel no bigger than a pea had gone in one side of his neck and out the other, and had just gone right through his spinal cord. And in other words, he was clean, if you could put it that way. I mean, there's nothing, no great blood or head blown off or anything like that. He was clean. There was just this little hole on one side or the other, and that's something that's always stuck with me, and this is why I mentioned this. But we used to fire, as I say, 400 rounds of 4-inch. We had trouble with these twin 4-inch, because in my own particular case, during one attack, And as I've said earlier, that I used to take up a position always at the back of the bridge where I could be always on call. And I had a shout from A gun that, the gun had fallen out, they'd said, had fallen out of its mounting. And this is something I rushed, and I just couldn't understand what had happened here until I got around onto the forecastle, and to my absolute surprise, I found that the gun had recoiled and had not run out again into its firing position. And this is a defect which we had all the time in that ship with these mountings, and I discovered then, and I suppose here this is going to be difficult to explain, but when a gun is fired, as anyone knows, if you fire a rifle, you get a recoil in the shoulder. If you're firing a thing like a 4-inch gun or any size of gun, you will get a recoil, and you see this quite frequently on when you see these things on television. But what is also the point, not only have you to take the force of the recoil with what is known as a recoil cylinder underneath, which is worked hydraulically, as it were, which absorbs the force of the firing, but you have also to get that gun back again out into its firing position. And in this particular mounting, it was done with air on the top. The recoil cylinder was underneath, and the recovery mechanism, if you like to put it that way, which pushed the gun back quickly into its firing position, was on the top. And this was charged with air, compressed air. And around this compressed air ram was a joint which comprised leather and a mixture of like kind of grease. And the mechanism worked such that when the gun recoiled, the pressure would build up in this leather and expand it, so that as the ram slid inside this leather seal, as it were, the seal would tighten and prevent this compressed air escaping. But of course this wasn't working effectively in our case. And the result was, when I got down, and I was absolutely horrified, I'd never seen this before in my life, which meant that we had to rig up, I had to get the armoured hose rigged on for the engine room with compressed air and recharge this gun and get the thing put out. But then it meant here, every action we fought, I was going around here very much with this air hose and the air pressure gauge, etc., to try to make sure that this wouldn't happen again. And even when we went back to our base in Londonderry, I'm afraid we couldn't find a cure for this. And we had another little, but I'll come to this later on, about the structure of the ship. But I'm perhaps gabbling on here a bit. But we fired, as I said, 400 rounds of a 4-inch used to go quite before breakfast. And it was quite a hectic period in Bramham's life. We found too that we had problems with the pom-pom. We had a 4-barreled, that's a 2-pounder pom-pom on there, and one of the problems on that, because we, if we're firing 400 rounds of 4-inch, well, one can well imagine how many rounds we were firing of the smaller 2-pounder. And one of the problems with this was, of course, we had cases which separate. That is, a case meaning that the pom-pom ammunition is supplied in a belt, and one belts up all